First case on the docket today, the poet Horace versus the rock and roll group Pink Floyd. Counsel for the plaintiff, your opening statement, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it is the contention of my client, the poet Horace, that an idea belonging to him was made use of by the defendant without his permission, infringing on his right to its originality, and without giving him due credit, monetary compensation, and artistic recognition for that same idea, namely, carpe diem qua minimum credulo postero. Thank you.
Excuse me, Counselor, but could you repeat that?
Certainly, Your Honor. Thank you.
No, the part just before that.
A carpe diem qua minimum credulo postero.
Counsel for the plaintiff, could you please approach the bench? You are aware, Counselor, that in referring to your client, you are pointing at a statue?
Yes, Your Honor, it is indeed a statue of the poet Horace, Your Honor. It is here in place of my client because he could not attend today's proceedings, Your Honor.
I see. And does your client have just cause for being absent from today's proceedings?
He does, Your Honor. He has a very good reason for not being here.
And what is that?
He has been dead for 2,100 years.
Yes. Well, there it is, then. Counsel for the defense, your opening statement?
Thank you, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my client, the defendant Pink Floyd, cannot be more shocked and surprised at being accused of stealing an idea and using it in a popular song. Frankly, we are outraged that such an accusation has even been considered. This
carpe diem qua minimum credulo postero. Get it right.
Yes, of course. Carpe diem qua... Your Honor, counsel for the defense moves that we shorten referral to this idea to carpe diem.
Counsel for the plaintiff?
No objections, Your Honor.
Bench rules this acceptable. Proceed.
And may we move, in addition, that the court refer to the counsel for the plaintiff, hereinafter, as a big doofus?
Objection.
Objection sustained. Counsel for the defense, would you please approach the bench? Counselor, are you aware that when you refer to your client, you are pointing at a record album cover?
I am, Your Honor, yes.
Am I to assume that this record album cover is here in place of the defendant?
It is, Your Honor. The defendant is unable to attend today's proceedings.
Just cause?
Indeed, Your Honor, the defendant is far too rich and famous to be dealing with proceedings as silly as these.
Well, there it is then. Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen, let us travel way back in time, way back, all the way back to the ancient days of 1973. And if it please the court, I would like to engage the help of the jury to examine a portion of this song as if it were being seen for the first time. I'm going to ask every member of the jury to gasp in surprise as soon as they recognize it, because there are some learned counsel among you who are likely to. If you don't know the song at all, don't worry, just listen to the words. Ticking away the moments that make up a dull day, you fritter and waste the hours in an offhand way, kicking around on a piece of ground in your hometown, waiting for someone or something to show you the way. Tired of lying in the sunshine, staying home to watch the rain. You are young, and life is long, and there is time to kill today. And then, one day you find, 10 years have got behind you. No one told you when to run. You missed the starting gun. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. As you can see and hear through this fine musical offering, my client, Pink Floyd, presents a song here and an idea that it is very dangerous and very sad to live your life as if you have all the time in the world. That so long as you think you've got time to kill, you're in danger of seeing your life pass by you before you know it. In short, that you must grab hold of every day, and not wait until tomorrow to do everything. Now, I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, and I ask you, Your Honor, do the lyrics we just heard relate in any way to those of the plaintiff's supposed original idea of carpe diem?
Counsel for the plaintiff?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please tell the jury and the court what carpe diem qua minimum credulo postero means.
It means seize the day, put no trust in tomorrow.
Counsel for the defense, your response?
Well, Your Honor, it seems we have something of a mystery here. I wonder if I might call upon my esteemed colleague to answer a few questions?
Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Learned counsel, you state that your client, the poet Horace, wrote his poetry 2,100 years ago?
That is correct.
Then it would not be unreasonable to assume that your client has been dead for 2,100 years?
That is a reasonable assumption. In fact, it is true. He has been dead that long.
Then we must further assume that any of his personal belongings, clothing, home, writing equipment, parchments, etc., for all intents and purposes, have turned to dust and scattered to the winds many centuries ago?
That, too, we shall accept as fact, yes.
And yet you claim that Pink Floyd made use of the work of your client. Can you answer me this? If he himself is gone, if his possessions and home are gone, yea, if everyone he ever knew is gone, how is it that his idea has survived all these thousands of years?
It is quite simple, Counselor. His idea was written down at the time he conceived it, and those written words were translated into many languages and preserved as a concept in the human mind.
But the words we just heard, the song, the idea it presents is true. It is valid. It has meaning.
Of course it has meaning. Why do you think the album has been selling steadily for the past 30 years? And it also had meaning 2,100 years ago when my client first wrote it.
Order. Order in the court. It is the ruling of this court that the carpe diem idea will continue to have meaning for the next 2,100 years as well. We further rule that counsel for the defense shall take copies of this statue of Horace and order that it be displayed in the homes of Pink Floyd band members from now on. We further rule that counsel for the defense shall go back to school and brush up on his Latin. And finally, we rule that counsel for the plaintiff shall go back in time and present the poet Horace with this Golden Record Award for Dark Side of the Moon. Court is adjourned.
Well, that might not have been quite as entertaining as most of the courtroom dramas you've seen. Matter of fact, it was a little corny, a little hokey, but it was trying to make a point. What was the point? Point is, ideas which are crafted by the tool words don't wear out. The idea in particular sees the day, carpe diem, 2,100 years old, just as valid as when it was first written, just as true. Moving a little further along in this argument, you know that if you ever tried to, you may know, you may not, if you ever tried to make something or work with something that required tools, whether it's a saw, a drill, a hammer, a pneumatic nail, or anything, you know that some tools are better than others. There are such things as cheap tools. There's that screwdriver that you try to take a really well-seated screw out with that strips, that just falls to bits. There's a little dollar store hammer that you could never hope to actually hammer a nail in with without the handle bending. There's the little drugstore portable tool kit that you could keep in your glove compartment. For what reason, I don't know. This stuff is made of metal that bends and falls apart if you think hard at it. And if you haven't worked with those kind of tools, I'd recommend that you don't ever, because they're worthless. Well, they're almost worthless. So some tools are better than others. And I think you'll find that even in the use of words as tools, some words are better than others, depending on what job you're trying to get done. I'm going to play an old recording. I think I did this one 2 years ago as part of my preparation for trying to get a presentation together. So settle back, relax, and listen to The Dating Game.
Hello and welcome to the wonderful world of daytime television. The sun is high, the kids are at school, the phone is off the hook, and that means it's time to play The Dating Game. Hello, I'm your host, Chet Chatterman, and welcome to The Dating Game, the show where three hopeful contestants try their best to win a date with a delightful young woman by answering her questions. She'll try to determine their personality, how much she'd enjoy their company, yes, and even what they're really like on the inside as she asks them questions one by one. As you know, our contestants will be hidden from their dream date by a wall, so none of them can see her and she can't see them. So without further ado, let's meet our contestants. Bachelor number one is a part-time taxidermist from Scrimshaw, Wyoming. He enjoys television, TV shows, and primetime viewing. Let's hear it for Ichabod Winebottle. Bachelor number two hails from Ratchetset, Kentucky. He's a full-time air freshener salesman who enjoys tennis, volleys across the net, and improving his backhand. Let's hear it for Aloysius Spoonhandle. Bachelor number 3 was born in Bismarck, North Dakota. He's a part-time carpenter and enjoys television, tennis, and reading books. Now please welcome Mordecai Kronksample. And of course, we can't play the dating game without bringing out our lovely young woman, unknown to our contestants and unseen by them throughout the game. Please say hello to Tina. Welcome, Tina. Listen, I've already introduced our Bachelor contestants, but I'll leave it to you to fill the audience in on who Tina is. So tell us about yourself. Won't you?
Thanks, Chet. It's really great fun to be here today. Well, I'm a full-time welder for a boat manufacturer in San Diego. I enjoy old movies, walks on the beach, and anything that's really romantic.
Fantastic, Tina. Well, gentlemen, you've heard what Tina likes, so do your best. Tina, let's start playing the dating game.
Okay. Well, Bachelor number 1. Hi. Hi, Tina. Hi. First question. If we were on a date at the Grand Canyon, what would you be taking pictures of? Are you kidding, Tina? Why, I'd be shooting roll after roll of film of nothing but you. Oh, how nice. Bachelor number 2, same question.
Pictures of only you, Tina. But I'd use a video camera so I could capture how beautifully you move.
Just me? Really? No scenery?
Tina, if I was on a date with you, there'd be no other scenery.
Ooh, luscious. Bachelor number 3, same question.
Why, Tina, I'd take no pictures at all.
No pictures? Why not?
Because there is no film, no snapshot, no mere earthly mechanism that could capture and do justice to you. I wouldn't waste my time fumbling with silly gizmos. I'd spend those precious moments we'd share together, memorizing every detail of your face. After that, what artificial image could compare to my immortal memory of your beauty? And years from now, if someone asked me about Tina, I won't produce a faded photograph. I'd simply call to mind my vision of you, and they will know by the look on my face how truly magnificent you are.
Okay. Wow. okay, Bachelor number 1. Next question. What do you think of my name? Your name? Like, I think Tina is a great name. I mean, you know, Tina. It's really cool. You know, a terrific name. Probably fits you like a glove. Just a wonderful little name there, Tina. Well, thank you. That's nice. Bachelor number 2, same question.
You can't have a better name than Tina. Give me a choice between Tina, Gina, and Wilhelmina, and I'll go with Tina every time.
Well, thank you, Bachelor number 2, I think. Bachelor number 3, same question.
Your name hangs like a tiny crystal bell within my heart. And when I hear you speak it, that bell rings and resonates throughout my veins, the perfect harmonies of love, echoing your name to the ends of my whole being. Tina. Tina.
Oh my. Oh my, that was... Bachelor number 1, if you could transform yourself into anything in the universe, what would it be? Transform myself into anything? I know. I'd transform myself into a really hot sports convertible for you to drive around in. Oh, how sweet. Thank you. Now, Bachelor number 2, same question.
I'd transform myself into a beachside mansion for you to live in, where I could keep you safe and warm and be waiting for you when you come back from your walks on the beach.
Wonderful. That's so nice. Bachelor number 3, same question.
If I could transform myself into anything in the universe, I would transform myself into your tears.
My tears?
Yes.
Okay. My tears. Bachelor number one, if you had... All right, wait a minute. Bachelor number three?
Yes, Tina.
Why would you transform yourself into my tears?
Because they are conceived in your heart. They are born in your eyes. They live upon your cheek and die upon your lips.
I hate to interrupt the proceedings here, Tina, but the time has come to choose which bachelor you'd like to... Tina? Where did she go? Tina?
Where did he go?
Tina? Tina?
Well, it seems that Tina and contestant number three have left the premises. Didn't even bother to wait for the end of the show. I guess it's pretty clear which contestant was using the best tools. And now it's time for Infinity again. We're going to play with Infinity one last time. And in this case, our mind-broadening exercise is going to be the Paradox Wristwatch. Let's imagine that we possess a wristwatch that is infinitely accurate. What do I mean? Well, look at your wrist and picture, if you don't have one on it already, picture an old-fashioned watch that has the hours, minutes, and second hands. It's ticking away the passing time and moving along as time normally moves along. But this watch is different. The closer you look, the finer the detail becomes. The second hand is ticking toward 12. And as you look closer and see that there's only 1 second left in the minute, you see that the watch is measuring off the half second as well. So you wait, and the second hand continues, but wait, the minute isn't over yet because the second hand has to measure off and pass through the last eighth of a second. And it moves toward the 12, measuring off the last eighth of a second. But the minute hasn't ended yet. Why not? Because this watch is infinitely accurate. It has to measure off the last 16th of a second. And then the last 32nd of a second. This micro pinpoint of a timepiece gets down to the billionth of a second. And what happens? Well, there's still a billionth of a second left. It's a stretch of time. And anything that exists with dimension can be cut in half, just like the grain of sand. If you use your imagination and mind to slice the remaining amount of time in half again and again, you will always have a stretch of time left over to slice in half again. The second hand never reaches 12. It doesn't end. It just doesn't end. All those tiny stretches of time slice down into infinity. Now, at this point, there must be a good number of you wondering just what's going on here. What does this have to do with words? Anum 5, you said this was going to be about words. You said that words were the tools for the people who set the rules. What's up with this infinity stuff? What possible use can I have these little games that you keep bringing up? Well, for one thing, they give you an idea of what's on a large scale and what's on a small scale. For another, they make your mind more agile and flexible. And finally, these little exercises serve to make a point, one of the most important points about this whole installment. Your body can't travel at 30 times the speed of light. Your body can't shrink down to the subatomic level. Your body can't exist independent of time in a minute that never ends. Your body can't do any of those things, but your mind can. Your mind can, with mental vision and imagination, your mind can achieve the impossible. And that's part of the secret, too. It's right out there in the open, but few people see it if they're not looking for it. Now, I can hear a few dissenting voices in the back of a few dissenting brains saying, "Come on, Anum. What does this have to do with the real world? My mind can do anything. My mind can do the impossible." Okay, suppose I travel to the ends of the universe in my mind every morning before breakfast. I'm still going to have to end up sitting in school. All these little mental exercises, they don't impress me because it's not real. Okay, let's talk about real. This is the part where we find out what power is. And so for the right here and the right now, you're going to have to indulge me with one more game, one more pretend mental exercise. And in it, we all imagine that we're in a school. And it's not tough to do because you've been there probably a lot longer than you wish you were. So it's easy to imagine that you're in a school auditorium. We're going to play the game called Real, and we're going to imagine that we're standing on a bare patch of ground where your school should be. Pretend that it's 2006. It's right now. And so in this game, we'll imagine that there's a school building there. We'll imagine that we're sitting in the auditorium of that school, because your mind can do the impossible. But don't worry, it's just a game. It isn't real. Now let's start making some connections. Let's follow a path that takes us from no building to a real building. All right. Now, your average school building is made up of tons and tons of cement, thousands upon thousands of bricks and cinder blocks, miles and miles of plumbing, pipes and copper wiring, hundreds of gallons of paint, truckloads of furniture, 800 or 900 light bulbs, and 2 goldfish. To build something where there is nothing requires a lot of what? Money? My psychic powers are hearing the word money. All right, this game is called Real, then I can't leave out money. Fine. Let's first agree that money is a tool, just like the bulldozers and cement mixers and power nailers and shovels and backhoes and cranes and dump trucks that you get together to build a school with. Okay, let's say all we need is money. Let's stand out in that empty field where we want a real school to be and imagine ourselves to be sitting in an auditorium that doesn't exist. But we'll think about what kind of power to use to make it real. We each have a $1 million bill in our hands. We wave it around in the open field and recite an incantation. Popeye, porridge, elastic foil, moon rock, iced tea, motor oil, ruta, vuta, zoot. And then nothing happens. It's still an empty field. Now let's put the $1 million bills back in our pockets for a moment and start from scratch. To build something where there is nothing requires a lot of power. Power. What power is there? And I mean real power. Let's start at the top. Let's leave the field and concentrate on power, starting at the top and working our way down. What is the biggest source of raw, flaming, burning energy that shines out as an example of power? He says as he's putting on his sunglasses. Yeah, that's not a tough one. The sun. It's pretty obvious. It's pretty big. And it's loaded with enough power to feed the entire Earth, all the energy it gets. And now then, can human beings control the sun? Turn it on and off? Vary its power output? Make it dimmer or brighter? No. Of course we can't. Not yet, anyway. All right, how about another form of power? How about the rotation of the Earth? There's plenty of power happening there. We're all in a massive ball of matter spinning around at 900 miles an hour. And we're moving around the sun at 1,140 miles a minute. Can human beings control that? Slow down the Earth's rotation? Make it take longer to move around the sun or go faster? No, we can't do that either. Massive amounts of power there, and we can't control it. All right, well, let's get smaller. Smaller than that. Smaller than the rotation of the Earth. How about the weather? Storm fronts, hurricanes, heat waves, all across the globe. Can we control that? It doesn't seem to me that we're capable of controlling that either. We can barely predict it, let alone control it. When was the last time you saw on the news that a hurricane was threatening the East Coast? But don't worry, our weather bureau will just stop it. No, we can't control the weather either. That's getting a little depressing. We don't seem to be able to control any of these massive forms of pure energy. All right, let's leave the top of the scale and start down at the bottom. Let's start on a really tiny level, the basics. Fire. Can we use and control fire? Yes. Great. We've been able to do that for a very long time. So what do we use to control fire? Stone and dirt and water. Okay, let's move forward a little bit. What if we want power that moves things or reshapes them without burning them? I believe the next step up would be water power. power of flowing streams and dammed up rivers. Streams turned wheels and spun grinding stones and made trip hammers possible. What did we use to control water power? Water wheels. Next up the line, steam. The pressure of steam. We've used that to move great big trains or lift massive hammers for pounding and cutting and spinning. What did we use to control steam power? Big metal boilers and steam engines. What next? What form of energy can we graduate to? Fossil fuels, oil, kerosene, gasoline. We'll use the explosive power of burning gas fumes to turn engines. Next, electricity. Electrical power. It's in use all over the world. It's for running machinery, lighting up cities, and cooking toast. What do we use to control electricity? Wires and switches. Nuclear energy. The power of atomic fission. That races ahead and leaves them all in the dust. What do we use for controlling nuclear energy? Giant concrete steel containment systems and radiation dampers. Now, we've got all this power under our control. We've got to be able to make a real building where there is no building. So here we are. Back in the empty field, and we have the imaginary idea of a school building, we gather all those forces together and get out the $1 million bills again, and gather up all the bulldozers and cement mixers and power nailers and shovels and backhoes and cranes and dump trucks and point them at the empty field and say, go to it, and then nothing happens. It's still an empty field. Because we left out one form of power. And by now you may know what it is. There's another form of power on Earth that is almost unbelievable in its strength. Next to the uncontrollable forces of nature and the universe, which we mentioned, the sun, rotation of the Earth, weather, next to that, the most powerful force on this Earth is a large group of people who all work toward the same thing. Doesn't matter whether it was 1,000 years ago, 100 years ago, last year, last month, or today. Next to the uncontrollable forces of nature and the universe, the most powerful force on this earth is a large group of people who all work toward the same thing. Millions of people. Is that true? If it's true, I should be able to give you examples. If it's true, there should be examples out there for you to look at yourself. You don't have to take my word for it, but I'll come up with a few. What power created the Great Pyramids? Millions of people. What power created and built the Great Wall of China? Millions of people. What power created the Panama Canal? Millions of people. What power led up to the development and the creation of the first sailing ships? Over time, millions of people. What power created the set of laws that allows everyone in this country to learn to read? Millions of people. What power over time developed the science, the research, and all of the hardware that eventually resulted in the piece of equipment you're using right now, whatever it is, to listen to this? Millions of people. Okay, so we're standing in the empty field again. We're imagining an auditorium and a building. But we want to make it real. We have this idea of a school building. We have all the discovered forms of controllable energy and all of the money and equipment necessary to get it started. What power do we really need in order to make it real? Millions of people. Doesn't take millions of people to build a school. Think again. Somebody had to make the wires. Somebody had to make the cinder block. Somebody had to design, research, and develop the machinery that digs the holes to pour the foundation. Somebody had to figure out how concrete was made. Somebody had to prepare the concrete. Put all those people together. Yeah, it's millions of people. Now, can that incredible power be controlled and directed? Here's where we connect the dots. We used stone tools and dirt and water to control fire. We used water wheels as tools to control water power. We've used big metal tools to control steam engines, boilers. We made complex engines as tools to control burning gas and oil. We insulate miles and miles of copper wire as a tool to control electricity. Big concrete and lead containment systems to control atoms. Now we're dealing with the sheer magnificent power of human will. What tools can we possibly use to control that? You have 3 guesses. It's what books are made of. Words. Now, you can doubt that part of the secret if you want, but you're going to have to think about it. Many people in history knew this part of the secret, and many people alive today are using it as we speak. Words. Now, I know there are still a good number of you out there who think, no, Annam, it's not words, it's money. Sure, you can motivate millions of people with the right words, but if you really want to get things moving, nothing beats cash. Let's take a closer look at that. That's fair. I can understand that, but let's dig a little deeper for the truth. If you want to get back into the real world, in your face, every day, nuts and bolts of it, fine. Suppose you do consider money to be the real power that shapes your world and your life. Let's follow it. Let's follow the money. It took a lot of money to build that school building. Whether you're in it now or you're going to go back to it, it took a lot of money to build it. I'll give you that. But where did that money come from? You can check this for yourself. I'm not making this up. The money that built the school that you're going back to, more often than not, if it isn't a private school, in most cases, it's tax money collected from the people living in your town or city. It was the tax money that those people paid because a law said they had to. Who made that law? Well, lots of political leaders and city planners and councils and committees, they all got together in various council chambers and courtrooms and meeting halls and at various times did what? They talked. So what tools were they using when they made that law? Words. So they talked. They talked about what the people and the city needed and how they were going to get it. They knew they needed money to get those things, like a school, and they finally arrived at the tax law, and they wrote it down. Words. Let's look closer than that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but let's find out where the truth of this is. Watch now. Let's find out where words fit in. Picture a lineup of things from your left to your right. Scribble it out on a piece of paper if you find it helpful. Let's start with the school. This is the school that the people built. Next in line, this is the money that paid the people to build the school. Next in line are the local officials who paid the money to the people to build the school. Next in line are the state authorities who control the money before it gets to the local officials. And then we have the people of the city or town who pay the taxes. And then we have the tax law. Now let's connect the dots. The people have children. They want their children to go to school. They tell their local official. Words. The local officials need money to pay for the school, so they have to convince the state officials to turn it over. Words. The state officials have the money because the people paid taxes because of the tax law. Words. Money doesn't do anything until the people controlling it are convinced to spend it. What tools could be used to do that convincing? Words. Now, if you still doubt that, turn on your radio and count how many commercials you hear in an hour. But we can look closer than that. We can go even deeper than that. We can cut past the surface of it all and get right down to the money itself. Let's say you and a friend stop in the local convenience store and you just want to buy a pack of gum. So you grab a pack of Juicy Fruit off the rack and you plunk down your dollar and you get your gum and maybe a few cents change. I don't know, how much is Juicy Fruit now? Is it $1.25? But your friend grabs a pack of Juicy Fruit and plunks down a pebble, 2 pieces of broken glass, and a twig. Well, your friend gets told to put the gum back on the rack and pick that junk up off the counter. Why? Because what makes a dollar worth a dollar? The quick and simple answer is, in this country, gold. And I'm sure you've heard the expression, I wouldn't do that for all the gold in Fort Knox. But the reason this dollar is worth anything is because of a legal agreement. The U.S. government, backed by all of the highest and lowest courts in the land, states that this piece of paper, the dollar, represents $1 worth of gold stored in Fort Knox. $5 bill, that equals $5 worth of that gold. $10 bill, $10 worth, and so on. If you don't have that agreement, then that little piece of paper is worth next to nothing. And how many people abide by this agreement? Only everyone who uses money. Forget about millions of people. How about billions? Now for the real answer. What is a legal agreement made of? Words. It all comes back to words. Now, to put a cap on this bottle, to finally leave this section of the circus, I'm going to admit flat out, I know money is important. Money is essential for you to live a decent life and pursue your dreams. I know that. It's very easy for me to just talk into a microphone and slice and dice reality. But when showtime is over, I know you can't buy groceries with words. You can't pay the rent with words. And you can't pay the oil bill with words. And so for those of you out there who still have money higher up on that meter of what really counts, that's perfectly okay. There's a hard truth in that, I understand. But I'll only ask you to do me this favor. Take as much time as you want and look as near and far as you want, but decide for yourself who is legally bringing home the most money in your town, your city, or your state, or the country. Observe the world. Just look around. This is part of the secret that some people don't get all their lives. The people that have that fabulous house, that gorgeous car, and that impressive bank account, I will guarantee you that what they carry with them to work and what they use all day in whatever profession they practice are words. You don't have to believe me. Check that out for yourself. It's right out in the open. It's obvious, but it's a secret because it's right out in the open. When you stare up at that office building, what tools do you think are being used in there by those well-dressed people who work there? The chief executive officer of a major corporation listens to words all day, discusses possibilities in person and on the phone, and reads reports. Is she smarter than you or I? Maybe, maybe not. But aside from the dollars and percentages on spreadsheets, all she works with are words. Words are the tools for the people who set the rules. By now, you should realize how powerful they are. You don't get pyramids, great walls of China, fleets of ships, armies of researchers, superhighways, satellites, or school auditoriums unless you convince large groups of people to want those things and to work toward creating them. So we stand in an empty field and play our harmless little imagination game where nothing is real, but we picture a school auditorium to sit in. That doesn't exist. It's not real. But when we express that idea in words and use them to influence the power of people, it becomes real. And our minds really have achieved the impossible. Almost everything we do, almost everything we think, certainly everything we build, from clay pots to governments, is shaped by words. Nearly everything you lay your eyes on today had its beginning somehow or another in words. Now, I played you a commercial that tells you they're more portable than anything else we have. You heard a court case that tells us the ideas they express last several thousand years. We heard a dating game where they made one contestant stand out as a clear winner and showed us that some words make better tools than others, and some people are better at using them. We looked at the shape of a person who never existed and yet is a worldwide celebrity, a person created by words. But they go beyond that. They go way beyond that. Just like any powerful tools, they can be used for good and for bad. Many people in history knew this. Martin Luther King Jr., he used those tools for peace and truth. He moved the minds and wills of millions of people by shining a light on the power of humanity itself and what could be accomplished by the simple practice of not hating each other and clearing our vision. What tools did he use? Money? You can't pay a society not to hate. He needed to draw upon every skill and inspiration he had to speak to the hearts and minds of every man and woman. Show us the truth. Help us discover it in ourselves. He knew that it would hurt because it was the truth. He didn't offer any easy answers. He gave us the hard answers. He used his intelligence. He used his eloquence. He used words. And as a result, millions of people are living with little more hope, and the course of history was changed for the better. Unfortunately, Hitler knew the power of words, too. Well, he used those tools for hatred and war and murder. He moved the minds and wills of millions by feeding their hatred and increasing their fear, trying to twist the world to fit his own warped mind. What tools did he use? Guns? Just Hitler? No, think about it. That one man and his little group of sick murderers didn't fire every gun and drop every bomb all by themselves. A massive number of people had to be convinced that that was the thing to do. He knew that millions of people could be influenced by attractive lies. He knew that millions of people could be influenced by easy answers. He knew that millions of people could be influenced by fear. He used words. And as a result, millions of people died, and the course of history changed towards human misery. So when you hear the expression, knowledge is power, the power is speech, increase your word power, the pen is mightier than the sword, they mean a lot more than you think. And when I say that the arrow of education is pointing to you, and it's pointing to power, I'm not just giving you a cute little catchphrase. And where you learn to use and master those tools, and where you come to understand when someone is using the tool of words to influence your world, for good or bad, where you come into that power for yourself, is in the book. It's what books are made of. Well, we've come to the portion where we're going to answer the easiest question. Now, I said earlier that the effect reading has on your mind is one of the biggest secrets because it keeps itself. The question is, how can a secret keep itself? That's the easiest question. If the effect reading has on your mind is so powerful and beneficial, why doesn't everybody read more than they do? Well, there's two answers to that. The first is, the effect reading has is invisible. You can't see it. Yes, you read a book and your mind got bigger, your imagination got stronger, your mental vision got sharper and clearer, but only by the tiniest amount. The effect is invisible in the short term. It's like everything else that requires effort. If you go to the gym and you work out on all the machines for just one afternoon, do you go home muscle-bound? Only in cartoons, folks. If you go to the gym and work out on all the machines every afternoon for 3 months, do you see any difference? Absolutely. If you read something you're interested in every night for 3 months, do you see any difference? Probably not. Maybe a little, but probably not. The difference is there. The sum of who you are became richer, and your skills at reading got better, but you can barely tell. There's no absolute way to measure it. So the secret keeps itself in that way. Here's the other way. The most obvious answer to the easiest question. If you like skateboarding, and I asked you, which would you rather do, read a novel or go skateboarding with your friends? The likeliest answer, the honest answer, from most of you, is going to be skateboarding. If you like music, and I asked you, which would you rather go out and buy, a CD of your favorite music or a copy of The Halloween Tree by Ray Bradbury? You're probably going to answer the CD. Sports fans, any of the sports fans listening, if I said the big game is on tonight, which would you rather do? Watch the big game, or would you rather write a story based on your last vacation? 9 times out of 10, you're going to tell me that you'd rather watch the big game. Now, you know what all those answers tell me about you? You're normal. You're a regular, normal, average human being. You gravitate toward things that you like to do. And if it's easier not to do something that we don't have to, we won't. The answer is so obvious and simple. Most people don't like to read. Most people would rather do anything else but read. So if you think you're alone in this, don't worry, you're not. We're all very much the same in that regard. If we don't like doing something, we won't do it. But the saddest joke about that is that music and movies and video games and skateboards and cell phones, sports, cool clothes, jewelry, television, all those things that you love and enjoy are created and marketed by people with strong imaginations and sharp mental vision. All those fun things appear to be more valuable than reading. All of them are competing for your attention against the book. And they're winning because most of the time, the very idea of picking up a book just makes you groan. Now, here in the United States in the year 2006, there have never been more forms of entertainment than ever before in the history of the world. It's effortless. You don't need to exercise your imagination. Somebody else will do it for you. Here's a little imagination game for you. One last thing to picture in your mind's eye. The television. Not tough to do. There it is, sitting wherever it sits in your house. Maybe you have two of them. And so if you've got one of those, you don't need sharp mental vision because somebody else will serve it up to you on a plate. One set of images after another. One string of sounds after another. One idea after another. Just as if someone had come to your house and showed you a series of pictures. Now you don't have to believe me. You don't have to take my word for any of this. But here's something that you might be able to research or find out for yourself, whether it's online or asking one of your teachers or whoever you know that would know this kind of thing. Find out how much money was spent to get commercial time during halftime on the Super Bowl. Do you really think that people would spend that amount of money if they thought it was worthless to take advantage of getting millions of people to all see the same picture and hear the same sounds? It's up to you. You figure it out. So let's leave here with a choice. Let's leave here with a choice. Now you can trust yourself to look around at the world and maybe see a few truths of your own. Just be observant. A bottom line that I hope you'll reach is that it's one thing to be content with how your life plays out if you are in control of it. But it's quite another to be forced to live a life with little or no choices because you can't see your own opportunities. The people who care about you don't want you to have to pay that price. Now I understand this has taken a good long time and it has been boring as hell. I understand that. I'm hearing it. I'm hearing it already. What am I presenting with you that you can use? Come on, Adam. Thanks for the history of the world in less than an hour. What about now? What about me? I'm not going to read 100 books and go out and change the world. I just want to go to lunch. All right. You've got a good point. Knowing the secret on a grand scale is one thing. Realizing that it can impact your life and your future, that's one thing. But what about today? What good does word power from reading do you if you can't even drive yet? Well, what I've been trying to get across here is not how to read, but why to read. And all I hope is that I've given you a few reasons to make it clear. So what do I have in mind? What do I expect? I don't think you're going to be sitting down to watch TV tonight and suddenly you're going to jump up and say, oh no, I mustn't watch this awful brainwasher. Adam said that I should read. Adam 5 said that I should pull a book off the shelf and read. I don't think that you're going to do that. Wouldn't hurt you in any way, but I don't think you're going to do that. I don't want you to stop doing what you enjoy anyway. That wouldn't be healthy. My hope here is that you'll do something for yourself. I hope that you'll think about the secret I told you. I hope that once in a while, you'll look at your world and you'll see how well that secret is hidden. Most of all, I hope that as you continue in school and out of school, when the grind of tests and homework, when all that starts to get to you, that you realize it's an arrow pointing somewhere else and that you'll be able to see past it. When I was in school, I hated homework. I not only couldn't see where the arrow was pointing, I got the impression that the only reason I was in school was to be programmed into a good little robot. And I hope you discover for yourself that that's one of the biggest lies of all. The books and the tests and the writing assignments, they're pounded into you year after year. Picture the television again, so that you don't become robots, so that you develop a mind of your own and you have your own dreams. And you can think about how to achieve them so that you have your own power, because you're going to get it so long as you continue with the words, and so that you have a bigger world at the end of the road. That's where the effect of reading comes in. It literally does make your world bigger. And the problem is, that's really difficult to see on the surface from one minute to the next. I hope you'll ask yourself, is the stuff they're teaching me really that boring, or does it just have too much to compete with? And if it really is that boring, nothing's preventing you from finding your own book or books or subject matter. There's nothing under the sun that hasn't been written about. Too difficult? Give me a break. You've got more brain cells in your head than there are stars in this galaxy. Just listening to this, you've contemplated astral, quantum, and temporal infinity, probably before lunch. I recited one paragraph, and you created a house, a dog, a storm. You know it's not too difficult. So write down today's date somewhere and keep it handy. It's the date you were told the secret. And as powerless as you may feel sometimes, you actually do have the power to make certain choices, whether or not you read on your own, and what books you want to read on your own. If you choose to take the power, then choose your own books to read. And when you choose your own books to read, never doubt that you're getting that power. You won't know it over time because you can't measure it or feel it. That's one of the things that makes educators' jobs so difficult, but they keep trying. And I've told you about this because your life depends on it. Best of luck. And best of days to you all. Thank you for listening.